From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Charles Dickens came to New York City in 1842 and wrote American Notes, he found little to praise. But two things drove him wild: Broadway and oysters. They make the mouths of idlers water, he said of New York's bivalves. Hard as it is to imagine today, for much of the city's history, oyster beds absolutely teemed across New York Harbor. It was Brooklyn oysters by the thousands that fed the Lenape Indians and delighted Dutch settlers. When American trade grew, the oyster trade boomed. Fresh oysters to the west, pickled oysters to the slave islands of the Caribbean. And in rows of Manhattan oyster cellars, bustling with prostitutes and drunks, oysters were slurped by the millions. Historian Mark Karlansky has harvested the rich history of the oyster and of the Big Apple. And in a new book, pried open its universal briny allure, he's with us this hour on Point. Oysters in their beds, oysters on the half shells, and oyster, the oyster history of New York City. You can join the conversation. Are you an oyster philiac? What keeps you diving into the half shell? Can you picture New York Harbor as a giant oyster bed? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll hear in a few minutes from oyster gourmand Chris Schlesinger. But first, joining me now from New York is Mark Karlansky. He's the popular historian who's captured the industry of telling history through food. His book, Cod, A Biography of the Fish That Changed the World, was a New York Times bestseller. He's also author of Salt, A World History. His new book is The Big Oyster, History on the Half Shell. Mark Karlansky, welcome. Great to have you.
Nice to talk to you, Tom.
It's a tremendous story. We just love it. And you bring to mind this picture of New York Harbor, which we see today surrounded by that giant skyline and all that traffic and all the we know has been dumped into it over the years, as an absolutely brimming, teeming home for oysters and oyster beds. Paint just the geographic picture, the topography and the terrain there under those waters that made it so, so hospitable for oysters way back when.
Yeah, you know, those of us who live here, forget about what the natural setting is, but it's New York City is the estuary of the Hudson River, a remarkable river in itself, and the floor of both the Hudson and the East River and all throughout the harbor was full of oyster beds, and the water was full of fish, striped bass and bluefish and tuna and shark and a tremendous variety of species. There's something like 200 species native to the Hudson River alone. So these were really rich and teeming waters.
You describe in your prologue, and I wonder if you might read just a bit of it for us, kind of the picture of New York, the New York paradox here. This is late in your prologue. You've got one of the great New York paradoxes. I wonder if you could read from there just to the end of that. It really paints the picture for us.
Sure. One of the great New York paradoxes is that the metropolis is both unique and typical. Many of its stories are true for other cities as well. The oyster history of New York often matches that of other great oyster capitals, such as Paris and London on the oyster-encrusted estuary of the Thames. It is interesting that London, rich in its own oysters, like New York, also destroyed them. Whereas Paris, which was the commercial and consuming capital of oysters, brought in from other regions, did more to preserve its beds. Before the 20th century, when people thought of New York, they thought of oysters. This is what New York was to the world, a great ocean-going port where people ate succulent local oysters from their harbor. Visitors looked forward to trying them. New Yorkers ate them constantly. They also sold them by the millions, supplying Chicago, St. Louis, Denver, and San Francisco, but also shipping to England, France, and Germany. As New York transportation improved, New York oysters traveled even further. In the 19th century, the British credited New York with meeting their oyster needs when their own famous beds failed. Oysters were true New Yorkers. They were food for gourmets, gourmands, and those who were simply hungry, tantalizing the wealthy in stately homes and sustaining the poor in wretched slums, a part of city commerce and a part of international trade. If eating an oyster is tasting the sea, eating a New York oyster was tasting New York Harbor, which became increasingly unappealing. The oyster was New Yorkers' link to the sea, and eventually it was lost. To New Yorkers today, eat not as many oysters, but still quite a few, albeit from a dozen other places. And now, when they think of the sea, they think of somewhere else. Perhaps the eastern tip of Long Island, or New England, or even Florida. Though they live by the sea, they take vacations to go somewhere else to be by the sea. Of the many odd things about New Yorkers, there is this. How is it that a people living in the world's greatest port, a city with no neighborhood that is far from a waterfront, a city whose location was chosen because of the sea, where the great cargo ships and tankers, mighty little tugs and yachts and harbor patrol boats glide by, has lost all connection with the sea, almost forgotten that the sea is there? New Yorkers have lost their oyster, their taste of the sea. This is the story of how it happened.
Mark Karlansky reading from his new book, The Big Oyster: History on the Half Shell. And you really do manage to tell the history of an entire city through this humble, wonderful bivalve, the oyster. It's really quite incredible. And it goes way, way back, you say, with the sort of the biggest evidence of the Native Americans, first people, Lenni Lenape, who lived there, the enormous mounds of shells they left behind.
Yeah, they're called middens, these huge heaps of shells. And some of them have been dated, to 6,000 B.C. and probably before the Lenape even were there. So in other words, people in this place have always eaten oysters in tremendous quantities. What particularly fascinated me, a couple of things particularly fascinated me about the middens. One is that if they were eating this huge quantity of oysters, oysters are not a very practical food, not a very high amount of protein given the amount of labor involved.
To harvest them and open them.
Exactly, and to lug them somewhere.
Right.
So what this means is, contrary to our image of earlier societies, they didn't eat everything for purely pragmatic concerns, that they, like people today, had a gourmet delicacy, something completely impractical that they just ate because they liked it.
When the Dutch showed up, they knew oysters. They knew their own from the other side of the Atlantic. But when they ran into the New York, the New World oyster, what did they make of it?
Well, the people who were, the Dutchmen who were actually here were delighted because they had the custom of eating oysters, and they thought these oysters were really great oysters. And the two biggest settlements were in what is today Albany and what is today Manhattan. Mm. And in Albany, they didn't have the oysters, and they used to ship them up to the Dutch settlers up there as a treat. But to the Dutch West Indies Company, to the people who were commercially concerned and started this whole project as a commercial project, it was a big disappointment because they said, oysters, we can have a pearl industry like we have in Brazil.
Not so.
Turns out, it's a complete misnomer, this thing of oyster pearls. Pearls do not, the pearls that are valuable do not grow in oysters. They grow in a totally different animal that's a different family and a different genus and species.
You've got two great peaks in the New York oyster history here. One of the naturally growing oysters that peaked very early on, and then another peak of those that were seeded and really deliberately farmed there. Describe each of those peaks. When did they happen? What brought us to the peak and then the crash?
Well, it's interesting to note that the Lenape also were over-harvesting oysters. And we know this because if you look at these shell middens, you see that the shells in the bottom were much larger than the ones at the top.
Interesting, yeah.
So they did what everybody does They grabbed all the big ones, and then when they were, grabbing too many for them to have time to grow, started grabbing smaller ones, and it got ever smaller.
And used them for everything, even burying their dead, you write. But that natural resource peaked in the early 19th century, is that right?
That's right. The Dutch harvested them even more than the Lenape, and... it was originally when the Dutch settled there, you just wander to the water and pluck some oysters for dinner or for a snack. And then they started saying that you couldn't take oysters anymore from the East River and the Hudson around the tip of Manhattan, which is where everybody lived, because they were wiping them out there. And they started wiping them out throughout the whole water system. So that by fairly early in the 19th century, they were in trouble.
But they came roaring back once they learned how to seed oysters, how to cultivate them.
Right. They got seeds from the Chesapeake. Then they had this seemingly endless supply, which, there's an interesting phenomena. It makes people get very sloppy about conservation and environmental concerns when you discover this, this man-made way of sustaining excess. It's kind of a right. Probably a lesson for fish farming.
And you think you can do it forever, and it turns out they couldn't. We've got to take a break. Listeners, we're talking with Mark Kurlansky. His new book is The Big Oyster: History on the Half Shell, all about the oyster and New York City. You can join us, 800-423-8255. What's your oyster story? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Oh, oysters, oh, oysters, oh, oysters, said she. I've got some of the finest oysters that ever you did see. Oh, 'tis very a penny I do sell, but four I'll give to thee, for to bargain for the best.
Funding for On Point comes in part from Loomis Sayles, researching and investing for pension funds, foundations, and individuals for more than 80 years, with a sincere commitment to giving back to the community. LoomisSayles.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about oysters and their beds, oysters on the half shell, and the oyster history of New York City. Mark Kurlansky is with us. He wrote Cod. He wrote Salt. Now he's written The Big Oyster: History on the Half Shell. It's all about the Big Apple and how the role the oyster played in its early centuries before that wonderful big harbor and all its estuaries could no longer support an oyster you'd want to eat. You can join us. Are you an oyster man or woman? Are you a half-shell maniac? Do you eat oysters to eat the sea? And are you ready to give New York the moniker the Big Oyster? Or is that your town, your city? Mark Kurlansky, you write about how the last of the oysters were harvested in, the late 1920s. But before that, you paint this amazing picture of the 19th century when oyster mania was at its height there. I'd love it if you'd read for us from, you've got Charles Mackay, very popular Scottish songwriter in America in 1857, writing his impressions of New York and his love of its New Yorkers and their oyster mania. Could you read something of that for us?
Right. He was forewarned before he left on his trip. A friend who was seeing him off said, "Oh, I envy you. You're going to New York." And he said, "Why do you envy me?" And he said, "Because you're going to eat the greatest oysters."
Let's hear it.
This is what he wrote. "The stranger cannot but remark the great number of oyster saloons, oyster and coffee saloons, and oyster and lager beer saloons, which solicit him at every turn to stop and taste. These saloons, many of them very handsomely fitted up, are, like the drinking saloons of Germany, situated in vaults or cellars with steps from the street. But unlike the German models, they occupy the underground stories of the most stately palaces of that city. In these, as in the hotels, oysters, as large as a lady's hand, are to be had at all hours, either from the shell, as they are commonly eaten in England, or cooked in 20 or perhaps in 40 or 100 different ways. Oysters pickled, stewed, baked, roasted, fried, and scalloped. Oysters made into soups, patties, and puddings. Oysters with condiments and without condiments. Oysters for breakfast, dinner, and supper. Oysters without stint or limit. fresh as the fresh air and almost as abundant, are daily offered to the palates of the Manhattanese and appreciated with all the gratitude which such bounty of nature ought to inspire.
Pickled, stewed, baked, roasted, fried, and scalloped, big as a lady's hand. That was 1857. It went away, but it was something while it was there. Let's begin to bring our listeners in. Ron's calling from North Augusta, South Carolina. Hi, Ron. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? You know, oysters have been a really staple of my family for a long time. We've had oysters, too, growing up every Friday night when I was a kid, if I remember, back in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
But my question was this. You know, they said never eat oysters in the month of what? And I had another question, too. The other question was, if it's an aphrodisiac, how long does it take to really hit you?
the Viagra question. Well, we'll pick them up. Mark, what about it?
Okay. Well, what is said in English-speaking countries is that not to eat oysters in months that don't have R, which is May, June, July, and August. This is something that goes back to Roman times and may have originated with the fact that, you know, oysters sitting out in the hot sun get spoiled.
Doesn't sound too good.
As waters heat up, oysters spawn, and spawning oysters are less plump is another possible explanation. But also, even after they learned that there was no harm, and there is no harm in eating oysters in these months, it was sometimes viewed as a good conservation measure to lay off of them during spawning season. The New York Times in the 19th century wrote a very angry editorial about all of this and said that they were going to start calling it Argus instead of August.
so
pointed out that what do countries do that, you know, where January doesn't have an R in their language?
and what about Ron's question on the Viagra issue of oysters?
Yeah, well, you know, it's my theory, Viagra included, that, you know, with aphrodisiacs, if you think they're going to work, they'll work.
Well, some people have thought. I mean, you've got Romans eating them at orgies and Casanova eating 50 before breakfast. I'm trying to picture that. Is there scientific evidence here, or is this just effective lore?
You know, it's interesting. Robespierre and some of the revolutionaries supposedly ate oysters when their revolutionary fervor was waning.
And Napoleon before he went into battle.
Napoleon supposedly ate them before he went to battle.
Yeah.
And there isn't too much scientific evidence of this. The world's record oyster eater. I have an email out to her to
ask her about her libido
reactions on this, because she ate 46 dozen in 10 minutes.
Wow, tearing up the curtains.
I don't know. I had an oyster party the other night, and nothing seemed to happen to anyone.
Ron, we're going to leave that to trial and error, and we hope you have fun experimenting. Mark, you were saying?
There is a high degree of zinc in oysters, and zinc is a building block for testosterone, so...
So maybe that's it. I want to bring the whole oyster issue right back up into our palates with somebody who knows them extremely well. Mark, joining us, with me here in the studio in Boston now, is Chris Schlesinger. He's owner and executive chef of East Coast Grill and Raw Bar in Cambridge. He serves 3,000 oysters a week at his restaurant. He's author of The Thrill of the Grill, among many other cookbooks. You may know him from On Air. Chris Schlesinger, wonderful to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you, Chris?
Good. I loved your book on cod, I just want to say. So I'm
looking forward
to reading this one.
Chris, you're watching people slurping oysters down every day, every week, every month, all the time. Who's drawn to oysters, and what is it for the oyster lover that just drives them, me, crazy?
Well, I think it's, you know, the magic of food. There's certain, you know, types of food out there that really excite people for their sensuality or their forbidden pleasures, you know, like chocolate or champagne or truffles or shark's fin. And I think oysters always have represented that to people, you know, and I think it's a pretty direct taste of the ocean and something that's always been considered a delicacy, a simple delicacy, you know.
And when people come in and they order their oysters on the half shell, and I assume that's the overwhelming favorite these days, and you watch them sitting over that plate, what's the kind of body language of preparation to begin the slurp?
Well, if you see the people, it's funny because everybody has a different opinion on how to eat it. It's kind of like barbecue. You know,
right.
Some people like it with just lemon. Some people like it with the cocktail sauce. Some people, I saw a gentleman last month order a glass of champagne and would dribble the champagne over the oyster and then slurp it. Okay. So there are all different styles, but I think people, you know, it excites people, and people are, you know, really react to them in a fun, visceral way, you know, and they really appreciate a good oyster.
Now, of course, everybody's got their favorites, and I think New Englanders may look, Mark Kurlansky, at your book and say, wait a minute, New York is the big oyster? That belongs up here somewhere. But, of course, it's hard to know now because we can't eat those New York oysters.
That's right. We don't know what they tasted like. I personally tend to like oysters better the further north they are. They seem to be brinier, which is the way I like them. And there are some great oysters in Massachusetts.
I love them, too. They're absolutely fabulous. On the other hand, I remember as a kid going down to the Gulf Coast in the spring, and oh, my gosh, the piles of oysters down on Dauphin Island off Mobile.
Right.
They're big, and you wouldn't walk away if you were an oyster lover. What about you, Chris? Where's your favorite lie?
Well, I agree with Mark. I like them up here in New England. I mean, an oyster is often attributed you know, for its terroir to a grape, you know, that where it's grown, it really impacting on the flavor. Oysters are filter feeders. They, you know, go through as much as 5-6 gallons of water in an hour. So, you know, where they live, the salinity of the water, the abundance of food, the type of food, all these factors go into, you know, given an oyster its unique flavor. But, I mean, I'm up here, and so I like the Wellfleet's. Duxbury, Mass. Has some really good oysters. Island Creek.
Eastham has good oysters.
Sure, Rhode Island, Narragansett Bay.
Mark?
When you consider that the oysters, all of the oysters of the eastern United States, from Louisiana and the Gulf to Florida to the Chesapeake to Wellfleet and up to Nova Scotia and Newfoundland, are all biologically identical.
That is, they're all the same species. It's just where they happen to be
exactly
growing.
They're all exactly the same species, and so you see how much the environment. I like Chris's wine comparison. It's really all about where they're grown.
But the range is tremendous. I mean, I've had oysters in San Francisco. Your reader said big as a lady's hand. It would have been a big lady. I mean, I've seen oysters just enormous in size, very much not like the New England scale.
Yeah, I've never understood why people want large oysters. I kind of like them small. But
you describe an English writer saying he's a little bit repulsed by North American oysters. Said they're big as babies.
Thackeray said that. Yeah.
Right.
He said it was like eating a baby.
Wow, that would be too much. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tell us your oyster story. You remind us, Mark Kurlansky, that when it's done right, when they're fresh, that oyster treat is a live treat. They're eaten alive.
That's right, with a beating heart.
I don't think most people think about that when they sit down to their oysters on the half shell.
Better not to think about it.
What is the biology of that glistening morsel there?
Well, you know, the abductor muscle, which keeps the shell closed, is, you know, it's an active thing. The muscle has to squeeze this thing that's like a rubber band to keep it closed.
Right, and it's very good at it.
Yeah, but that's why when they die, they're open.
Mm-hmm.
So people make the mistake of thinking that, you know, you cut that muscle, you know, and then they're open and they're dead. But some biologists compared it to hamstringing cattle. You know, if you have a hamstring cattle, it's still alive. I mean, all you've done is cut the muscle of this animal, and it's still completely alive. If they're not alive, you don't want to eat them, actually.
I mean, the Chinese do that with plenty of seafood, but oysters, the one we do right here, and may not even think about it. Let's take a call. Chris is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
We're good. What do you know, Chris?
I grow oysters in the Sconnet River. Chris Lessinger may know where that is.
Absolutely.
Sure.
And I just wanted to comment on some of the things that you talked about. When to eat them, when not to eat them, what a pain it is to grow them, how hard it is to grow, the price we get for them, how perilous an industry it is. We had a huge industry here in Rhode Island at the turn of the 20th century, and that was all natural beds, and that's pretty much gone now. Through a series of events,
Chris, what's your suggestion of the best time of year? When do you, I mean, you rake them up. When do you suggest their best? What time of year?
Well, Mark pointed out that they spawn just before summer, usually in June when the water temperature gets about 50 degrees Fahrenheit is when they go to spawn, but they build up what's called glycogen up until that point, which gives them their plumpness.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people would argue that the best time to eat them is just before June, like in May, maybe April or May. I prefer them in the fall, like most people, probably because of the ritual, the harvest ritual.
Right.
But you can eat them anytime.
Mark Kurlansky, you point out they hibernate, and in the fall they're putting on plumpness for that as well. Good time.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things about oyster eaters is that different people want different things from an oyster. And so, you know, as in all this discussion of the best kind of oyster, it depends what, you know, what you like in an oyster. Southern oysters to me are very bland. But a Southern oyster lover would say that they're mild and subtle.
Mm, right, right. And Chris, our oyster farmer there, how's it going these days? How's the crop been in the last year?
Well, I'm pretty fresh to the industry. I've been growing for 3 years, which is a tiny amount of time compared to most of the established growers here in the state.
Yeah.
But it's rough. Mostly it's the regulatory aspects of it, and then I grow under a dock, so I have to pay for insurance, and there's all kinds of overhead that you wouldn't think would be involved, not just things like equipment, but lots of other types of overhead that cut into your profit. And it's a very cutthroat industry to sell to wholesalers, which I try not to do, and even to sell to a restaurant, it's cutthroat because there's a lot of competition from places like Canada and places further down the coast. So it's not easy.
Yeah,
put it in a nutshell.
We hear that it wasn't easy when they grew in abundance naturally, and it sure as heck isn't easy today. Chris Schlesinger, are you one of these cutthroat recipients of the oysters? Do you feel all the different suppliers out there, or are you depending on guys like Chris up to his hips?
Well, no, I mean, you know, what we haven't talked about is the, you know, I mean, 100 years ago the oysters were plentiful, and now I think with, you know, the Chesapeake Bay is pretty much really depleted, and so I think instead of the wild harvest, there are people cultivating oysters, and to get them, they're dealt with formerly more in the bushel, and you know now they're dealt with by the piece. And people like Chris taking time, and you know, some of the people that cultivate oysters will touch an oyster personally over 8 times during their life, and they're really a handcrafted product. And to serve a quality oyster, I mean, not only does it matter where they're from and what they've eaten, but it matters how they were grown and how fresh they are when you get them. So cultivators are now, I mean, all our oysters come directly from the growers, and we don't take the risk of going through the middle people because you don't know how long the oyster's going to be around. But
Mark Kurlansky, you write about how oysters were actually trained in the 19th century to clam up, to clamp shut so they could be shipped long distances. How on earth did they do that?
Well, the French used to do it with a little iron rod, and they would move them a little closer to the tide every day and tap them with this rod, and they would they would clamp down as soon as you touch. An oyster closes up if it senses danger,
mm-hmm.
So then they would associate danger with getting out of the water and. I don't know how scientific this is, but they did it.
You described New Yorkers in the 19th century giving them a little less seawater each day until they learned to climb up in conservative a long time so they could get on the U.S. rail
right.
system brand new and head all the way to, I don't know, Denver.
Right, because, you know, the thing with oysters is keeping them live. And if you, you know, even if they've been out of the water for some time, if they're still alive, they're still good oysters. And, you know, they have very thick shells, and they have one shell that is curved. And if you store them with the shell that has that kind of well in it on the bottom, They're actually a surprisingly durable product.
Keep that, keep the liquor in there, and they'll stay fresh longer than you might think. Mark Kalansky's new book is The Big Oyster. Chris Schlesinger of the East Coast Grill in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is with us as well. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Can you imagine eating yourself silly off oysters straight out of New York Harbor? 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Down by the sea lived a lonesome oyster, every day growing sadder and moister. He found his home life awfully wet and longed to travel with the upper set. Poor little oyster.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And RHR International, an executive and organizational development firm committed to integrating executives into new roles.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with historian Mark Kurlansky. He wrote about cod. He wrote about salt. He's written now a book called The Big Oyster, History on the Half Shell. It's all about the bivalve and about New York City, which kind of grew up on the backs of oysters. Chris Schlesinger is with us as well, owner and executive chef of East Coast Grill and Raw Bar in Cambridge. Serves 3,000 oysters a week, knows a little bit about them. What about you? Can you imagine eating yourself silly off oysters right out of New York Harbor? What is the allure of the oyster for you? Did you know you're eating them live? And where do your favorites come from today? Or do you care as long as they're fresh, cool, wet, slippery? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Bruce is calling from Palisades, New York. Hi, Bruce. You're on the air.
How you doing?
We're great. What do you think?
I'm actually looking down at the Hudson River now.
Excellent. Excellent. You're getting hungry.
Listen, I grew up on the North Shore of Long Island, so, you know, oysters have been a part of our life for quite a while.
Yeah.
And so I want to put a plug in for Oyster Bay Pine Island oysters, which they grow in Oyster Bay out in the North Shore of the island.
All right.
But my question is on my way upstate, I have an old Hudson Valley cookbook, and I was wondering if you guys were familiar with the old roasted oysters with leeks and butter sauce recipe.
Roasted oysters with leeks and butter. We'll put it first to you, Chris. Do you still even roast oysters at the restaurant?
People,
is it all wrong?
Well, down in, I'm from the Mid-Atlantic, Chesapeake Bay region, and oyster roasts are a big deal down there where they take the clumps of oysters and just roast them right in the fire. Was that with the shell or is that out of the shell?
This way, you know, I opened them, you open them raw, and I just roast them a little on a bed of salt, rock salt and pepper, and just until they start to curl,
right.
And then I ladle in the butter and it's supposed to be an old Indian or Hudson River recipe. So
you're getting our attention, Bruce. You've got us fully. Mark Kurlansky, how about it? You've got a lot of recipes actually in this book, out of history. Does that one sound familiar?
Well, first of all, the Lenape probably roasted oysters. We don't know how they got their oysters open because we've never found any tools that were capable of opening oysters till Europeans arrived.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
but
thought
they did
that
it
they probably they probably roasted them because the heat would open them. Mm-hmm. Roasted oysters were a traditional New York way of eating oysters. There were stands on the street where you could get roasted oysters, and all of the markets served roasted oysters, and it was a very New York thing.
Oysters with leeks. You've got oysters many ways in here. I loved your story of how starting with lobster Newberg and the story of Delmonico's, of course, the big where the rich ate their oysters. Fruit merchant Ben Wenberg comes up from the Caribbean, shares this recipe. Delmonico's flip it around because they had enough of him, call it Newberg, and pretty soon it's Oyster Newberg, not just Lobster Newberg. I wish you'd read a recipe for us there, if you could, for Oysters Newberg this was from Ladies' Home Journal in, I'm not sure when, 1894. 15 new ways for oysters. I love this recipe.
Right. Notice the quantity. drain 50 oysters. Pour over them a pitcher of cold water. Have ready a granite pan, smoking hot, throw in the oysters, add 2 ounces of butter, a teaspoonful of pepper. Stir carefully with a wooden spoon until the oysters are smoking hot. Have ready the yolks of 2 eggs beaten with 6 tablespoons of cream. Add quickly. Do not boil. Then add a tablespoonful of sherry and serve on nicely browned toast.
There you go. Start by draining 50
little light
oysters.
Snack there.
A little light snack. Amazing. Chris Lessinger, when you hear an old recipe like that, does it sound like another era to you?
Well, I think in the development of the continental cuisine as embodied by Delmonico's, there was a tremendous use of oysters, you know, from the oyster stuffings to oyster stews and fried oysters. So cooking the oyster, to me, in these old ways, in these rich combinations are, you know, traditional ways to do it. And I think it, you know, the oyster is a lush item. And, I mean, to make oyster stews when I grew up, and as my mother opened a quart of heavy cream and pour it in there and throw right. some oysters in there.
And then you melt a pat of butter on the
yeah,
top.
Yeah, right. That was a ball game. So.
Right. And on you go. Mark Kurlansky, you write about the unbelievable volumes in which people ate oysters in the New York heyday. Describe that for us. Diamond Jim Brady and the rest.
Yeah, you know, a few dozen oysters before dinner.
For one.
You know, the truth is, one of the great things about oysters is that you can eat a lot of them without getting terribly full.
Yeah, don't fill up on them. They're a great appetizer and appetite encourager.
Please.
Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
No, I mean, I think that's one of the great things about oysters as a food is you can eat a dozen or two dozen before dinner and it doesn't really hamper your – I think it encourages your appetite.
Yeah, I don't know how this half a dozen thing got started. I like to have a dozen, you know.
Yeah, really, yeah, half dozen.
Well, it may be that they're not 6 cents for all you can eat anymore.
Well, you know, that's a really interesting thing about – From the time of the American Revolution to 1927, when the last of the New York beds were closed, the price of oysters barely rose at all, and it was always incredibly cheap. When they first invented hot dogs, a guy invented a steam table that you could take out on the street.
Yeah.
And in Coney Island, you could get a plate of oysters, a dozen oysters, for what one hot dog cost. It's about the only food I've ever run into that was for rich and poor people alike in the same kinds of preparations. You could go to a slum and an oyster cellar and eat oysters, and then you could go to Delmonico's for a banquet for a visiting president of the United States and eat the same oysters in the exact same way.
These oyster cellars, as you described them, pretty wild and woolly places, and the pleasures of the flesh often not far.
Right. I think that this also had to do with it, with this idea of oysters as an aphrodisiac. You know, this was a time when women, unescorted women, were not allowed in restaurants. But women of, as they said, ill repute could hang out in oyster cellars, you know, so you just had it all right there, the oysters and the women.
A few dozen in the front of the bar and, what you will, in the back of the bar. Thomas is calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Thomas, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Earlier in the show, a comment was made about the milder taste of the southern oyster.
Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. And we do, I live near Merrill's Inlet, and we have a very salty oyster because of the salinity of the water. But that has pretty much died out, and we're getting a lot of imported from Louisiana. But a buddy of mine showed me a trick. We take them by the bushel in a croaker sack and hang them over a dock and overnight in Merrill's Inlet, and osmosis occurs, and so we get a lot saltier version of the farm-raised oyster.
So you'll take your oyster from wherever it comes and southern fry it off the dock there in a way. Get the salt in there.
Yes, sir.
I love it.
And it actually works very well because to me, the farm-raised ones are a lot less tasteful.
That's a great story. What do you say, Mark Kurlansky?
Well, you know, that's interesting. In the 19th century, when Blue Points were a really hot item and they couldn't produce enough in Blue Point to supply Europe, they were in great demand in London.
These, of course, from off Long Island Sound, yeah.
Right. And they started taking Staten Island oysters and bringing them over to the Great South Bay and putting them in for a couple weeks and then shipping them out as Blue Points. And the British apparently tasted the difference and caught them and took them to court on this. And you know, they argued, well, they are Blue Point because they lived in Blue Point water for a couple of weeks, right. Which seems to be what this man's experience was.
The British took their Blue Point seriously. Chris Lessinger, what about the way oysters are farmed, produced, cultivated today as a culinary, as a gustatory experience? Here's Thomas in South Carolina hanging them off the dock for overnight to get them where he wants them.
Well, I think it's kind of ironic because when the guest, the diner, sits down to eat an oyster, they just see the oyster, but they don't see the amount of time that's gone into raising the oyster and, you know, getting the oyster from the ocean to the restaurant. And then you also have the expertise of the shucker,
right.
Which is also, you know, got a tremendous history. I was just down at the U.S. Championships in Mohican Sun.
Oyster shucking championships.
Yeah, which
okay.
is... And,
at a casino, of course.
We had the world's champion from Galway was in, and he actually beat a couple local guys.
How'd he do? What was
the
rate?
What was the record?
Well, he did. I mean, I think it was like it was how long it would take them to shuck 60 oysters. Mm-hmm. And it was not only because it was kind of a restaurant thing. It was not only about how fast they would be open, but how clean they were open.
Course,
and
yep.
if there was any debris and kind of the professionalism of a, mm-hmm. I mean, a properly shucked oyster without any meat cut or anything like that.
And no bits of shell.
Is it, you know, not only to get them fresh and grow them properly, have them taste great, that they need to be shucked properly also.
What about what was the rate? 60 in how many minutes?
He did 60 in like 2 minutes, and they were all in pretty good shape. There are deductions for different things.
60 in 2 minutes. How would that
good.
Look in the heyday of New York shucking, Mark Kalinske?
Well, the 1870 record was 100 oysters in 3 minutes and 3 seconds.
Well, that guy could have won.
Right. I mean, I don't think I could take 100 oysters and just pick them up and put them down.
No,
in
shucking
three minutes
is
and 3 seconds.
Shucking is incredibly hard. When you see good shuckers, it's really an
right.
art form.
Absolutely. I want to bring one more voice in with us. Andy Wilner joins us from Keystone, New Jersey, executive director of New York, New Jersey Bay Keeper, which works to protect and clean the Hudson River and Raritan Bay in New York Harbor. They're attempting to redevelop oyster beds in Raritan Bay and New York Harbor. Andy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So tell us, is it going to work? Can you bring them back? It's been the better part of a century.
Well, it's already working. We have 400 volunteers who do oyster gardening in both New York City and northern New Jersey, and we have 3 beds that we're restoring, and last year we had our first success in our experiment, which is that we had a natural set of oysters from our bed in Red Bank, New Jersey.
And so it's working. Can you imagine oysters living all over New York Harbor, the estuaries again?
Well, the conditions are right. The first thing we did when we started this process now almost 10 years ago is we set out bags of oysters in places as unlikely as the Gowanus Canal and Newark Bay and other places, mm-hmm. just to see if they would survive.
Yeah.
That experiment worked, and we went on to understand, based on advice from our scientists, that we needed to go bigger. And so we built these beds out of oyster shell and clam shell and then planted oysters on them to kind of jumpstart the process.
Now, is your goal to bring oysters back to clean the harbor or bring oysters back to eat?
Well, primarily, our goal is an ecological experiment. We want to make sure that oysters can live here, and as I guess all your guests have said, they're great filterers. So as a result of more oysters, we believe that we can get better water clarity because they filter material out of the water. We have highly nutrified water in New York Harbor, so algae blooms occur, and we think that that can help to abate algae blooms. But eventually, as water quality improves, and certainly the other half of what Baykeeper does is to advocate for cleaner water, we believe that there can be a boutique oyster fishery again in New York Harbor, hopefully within my lifetime, and I'm an old guy, but I also think perhaps faster than most people think.
Mark Kurlansky, how about it? The PCBs that come down the Hudson, can they...
Yeah, I have a question for Andy. It's my understanding that right now, the oysters would not be advisable to eat them because of PCBs and heavy metals. Isn't that right?
Right, absolutely. Our gardeners and our experiment has to do with improving the ecology. Oysters are a keystone species for a lot of other plants and animals in the harbor, and we don't advise people to eat them. As a matter of fact, we must count every oyster we give out to our gardeners and get them back to plant so that we're not having people eat them. We don't encourage people to eat them. However, right. I think what's little known about New York Harbor, particularly the Raritan Bay section of New York Harbor, is that it's one of the largest shellfish industries on the East Coast. It's the hard clam that's harvested here, not the oyster right now.
Don't rush in to eat the oysters quite yet until you get the all clear. Let me get one more call here. Derek from Newport, Rhode Island. Hi, Derek. You're on the air.
Hi. My comment is about the dangers of oyster shucking.
Okay.
When I was 15 years old, my family had a reason to move from rural New Jersey to Newport, Rhode Island, which is coastal.
Yeah.
I got a job at a restaurant, and I was quickly out shucking even seasoned sous chefs and others, but learned quickly to hold a rag in my oyster hand, because I saw more than one guy, while levering an oyster open, put a knife right through his oyster hand.
That's what we call the natural cocktail sauce.
Yeah.
Did
you come away with all your fingers and thumbs, Derek?
I can't, yeah, and then unperforated. And I wasn't a world-class shucker, but I was able to open, at my best, about 22 oysters per minute.
That's pretty good. You jumped right in and did it, and we're glad for the story. Mark Kurlansky, you look out over that harbor today. Of course, it's a story of what was lost when the cleanliness, I mean, you described the amount of industrial waste and sewage at one time that was going into New York Harbor. Now we hear Andy Wilner saying they're coming back little by little and maybe one day even to eat. Can you see it turning around?
Yeah, I could see it turning around if we continue to have our will to. I mean, we have to remember that all of the tremendous progress that's happened in New York Harbor and Boston Harbor, for that matter, is a result of the environmental movement of the 1970s and the Clean Water Act, and that these sort of things are not what's happening now. And unless we keep on it, good news is going to be over.
There's a lot of pressure on the estuaries in New England, and I think oysters can become a real indicator of the quality of water because, you know, with all the runoff and the industrial and residential development, oyster beds and clam beds are being constantly open and closed with the amount of runoff and stuff like that. So I think that getting oysters out of the water and eating them would be a good thing if we could do more of it.
Canary in the coal mine. Andy Wilner, drifting the right direction right now from what you can see, or is it still teetering here?
Well, we're still teetering. Remember, we have millions of people in the greatest metropolis on Earth, right on the edge of the greatest estuary on Earth, New York Harbor. So I think that there's always going to be a balance. Our hope is that the balance goes towards cleaner water and harvestable shellfish.
Mm. Andy Wilner with Baykeeper, joining us from Keystone, New Jersey. Thanks so much for being with us, Andy.
Thank you.
Mark Kurlansky, I love your little quote here from Eleanor Clark's wrote about oysters, saying, obviously, if you don't love life, you can't enjoy an oyster.
Right.
It's alive. It's alive. And maybe in New York Harbor, again. Chris Lessinger, I want to thank you so much for being with us for a little oyster slurping today. It's been wonderful to have you. We'll have to be over at your raw bar soon. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Chris Schlesinger, author of The Thrill of the Grill, owner and executive chef of East Coast Grill and Raw Bar. And Mark Kurlansky, you brought us the cod, you brought us the salt. Now you've got the big oyster here. We're grateful to you for your popular history and for your time today. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure. Let's go over to Chris's and have some well fleets.
We'll lift them. Mark Kurlansky's new book, The Big Oyster, History on the Half Shell. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.